good morning, Reality Church. Wasn't this a great week? Isn't this a great week? Did everybody get to go to Minneapolis to see the Cowboys beat the Vikings? Yeah, well, I did. It was awesome. So glad you could be here today. My name is Lance. I'm one of the pastors here at Reality Church. And if you're a first timer, welcome. We're so glad. We know you could be a lot of different places today, and you chose to be here, or else someone forced you to come with them. And so welcome. We are actually closing out a series called Better. We've been studying the book of Hebrews, and I've just had a blast. It's been an amazing kind of journey for me because I've done a lot more study than I've been able to preach. And hopefully, if you've been reading through the book of Hebrews, it's kind of raised some questions for you. I want you to know that I'll be right over there by that rocket after the service is over. So if you've got some questions about Hebrews or questions about theology or God or anything like that, I'd be happy to answer those with you, and we might step into that really cold section of our new building and talk about that. So yeah, it was a fun trip. I got to go and see the Cowboys win. It was Roger referenced the referees, okay? And I will acknowledge that there were a lot of bad calls against the Cowboys, and yet they overcame them and won the game. On the way back, I was on the light rail. We got on a beautiful stadium, by the way, and got on the light rail, and we're headed back to Mall of America, and there was this Vikings fan, dejected dad, okay? Face paint, Vikings gear, it was just like, and he was just sitting there in all of that, loss, and I was like, yeah, I'm a nice guy. So I'm talking to him, and his son is sitting next to him. And I'm like, oh, what a horrible. I remember going to games and, believing that they would win and they lost. And so I'm talking to him about how beautiful the stadium was. And I'm saying, that's just a horrible way to lose the game. It's just, I'm sorry. But, I was really genuinely feeling that. This little boy was sitting there. And so then I lean down and I start talking to his son. And I say, I remember the first game my dad brought me to. It was at Texas Stadium. And about midway through the game, Dad hands me his binoculars and he says, son, I want you to look at number 10 because he's one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game. Focus in on him. Watch what he does. And I got my binoculars and I looked through my binoculars at number 10. And you know who that was? That was Fran Tarkenton, one of the greatest quarterbacks ever to play the game. Do you know who that is? I'm looking at this little boy. I'm trying to give him a memory, And the kid says, I don't know who that is. I'm a Cowboy fan. I'm like, this whole time I'm trying to console this kid. He's actually working against his dad, happy that the Cowboys won. And there's a house divided there. And I'm like, I just felt like a loser. But he wasn't wearing any Cowboy gear. How was I supposed to identify this kid as a Cowboy fan? And his dad was all decked out. I just assumed. So anyway, I think we should have the day before at Mall of America, you could identify every Cowboy fan. I felt like I was in Dallas. They were everywhere, and we were like, go Cowboys, fist pump, and stuff like that. And it was good to feel a part of the community, We did that when I was growing up as a Christian. Everybody knew who the other Christians were because we were the ones wearing those cheesy Christian T-shirts. You guys remember those? Like where you would take like a, there's that one, I got this, God. But there were actually way worse ones than this. You remember Pepsi, the choice of the new generation? Well, we had one that looked just like it that said, Jesus, the choice of the new generation, because we were just that cheesy back then, all right? We had one that, Jesus was bench pressing across, it was some sort of athletic thing, and it said, bench press this, and it was just, as I look back, even though I owned that shirt, I'm a tad bit embarrassed by it. But we have everything to identify Christians. We had our witnessing bracelets, you guys remember those? Multicolored beads on a bracelet that each meant something, that if somebody asked you what it was about, you could tell them what each color meant. You were just hoping somebody would see you. You could identify Christians by their bumper stickers, by their T-shirts, you could just pick them out in the crowd. But let me ask you a question. If we didn't have any of that stuff, if we didn't have Christian T-shirts or Reality Church swag or Christian radio stations or any of that stuff, what would people in our community, what would people in our world do to find out who we are? How would they identify us as believers? What would make us, can you guys just turn, look over there. What would make us stick out from the norm? You and me. as a believer, what would make you and me say, you know, I'm a Christian. Should my life look different? I'm a Christian. Should the way I treat people look different? How are people going to figure out that guy's a believer? Maybe that guy's not. I mean, can people who aren't believers act nice? Yeah, absolutely. So what makes me stick out in a world that's desperately needing to know Jesus? What makes me stick out from the norm? Should my life be better than the norm? Should my life blend in, look like everybody else? Should my values look like everybody else's? Should my habits look like everybody else's? Or should a believer live in a way that's better than the norm? Not that we feel like we are better, but should we live in a way that sticks out? This sermon is going to be one of those, I promise you. I think it's going to be one of those where nobody comes out unscathed, where there's going to be an ouch for everybody in here. And guys, that is okay. Because the whole first part of this series has been about, you know, Jesus is better. Convincing us that Jesus is better than anything else we've got. But that has practical consequences. If we really think that Jesus is better, then that changes the way we live. How do we pick out people that are believers? Well, we label people. I don't know if you do, but a lot of people, you meet somebody and you go, you kind of put a mental label on them. Maybe at work, you've got those people that you say, oh, that's the nice one. When you look at them, that's the nice one. That's the nice label. They get coffee. They replace the paper in the printer. And they clean out the microwave when their barbecue sandwich explodes in there. Instead of leaving it for the next person, they're the nice guy. You know, they're the one that everyone kind of likes to be around. There's the sarcastic one where, you know, you meet them. They say something to you like, nice shirt, Lance. And you spend the rest of your day wondering, did he like the shirt? What did that mean exactly? So there's always the sarcastic one. There's the lazy one that you can't get any work from. They've always got an excuse. They show up late to everything. Their eyes are swollen. It's like, what do you do? And it's like, they don't do anything. They just kind of take advantage that other people are doing stuff. There's the lazy one. There's the stinky one that everyone's wondering, who's going to tell them that they stink? Somebody's got to tell them that let's get the nice guy to tell them they stink. So, because he'll at least do it in a nice way. There's the crazy right-wing nut, you know, it's like they'll have my guns when they pry them from my cold dead fingers, you know. And you got, you know, it's always, everything's political. Thanks, Obama. That's what they say at everything. And then you got the left-wing nut that during their lunch break is out there hugging a tree, you know. Then it's, did you eat? No, I don't eat. It's killing living things. I don't know what they do. Anyway, you got those people. You got the encourager. That's nice. They high-five everybody. They say, we can do it. We got this. No big deal. You guys, we have those labels that we give to people. And in fact, on our church staff, we're going to give out a Fred Award, which is basically someone who fills in the gaps, who goes beyond, above and beyond at our Christmas party. That encouraging person. We all kind of want to be those people. But when it comes to Christians, what label would people put on you? In your work environment, at school, in your family, what label would they put on you? Because we have a culture out here that behaves in a certain way. Man, should we look different? Should something about us stand out to where they go, ah, that's a believer. That's got to be a believer. So that's what's going on here. The believers that we're talking about in the book of Hebrews, they didn't want to stand out. Because every time they stood out, people were taking things from them. They were getting persecuted. Not like American persecution, where somebody made fun of you, or somebody said, oh, you're a Christian, you're a loser, you know. No, they were getting their property confiscated. They were losing their jobs. They were being imprisoned. Eventually, many of these Christian believers that were being written to in the book of Hebrews were going to lose their lives. So they didn't want to stick out. They wanted to blend in. They were really tempted to go back. So the first part of Hebrews that we've been looking at all the way through chapter 12 is kind of been like a coach's pep talk. When you're in the locker room and you're down by a lot of points and the coach is saying, we still got this. Don't worry about it. We're going to come back. And there's the pep talk, and then there's chapter 13, which almost looks like it's separated from 1 through 12, but it's not, because it's the X's and the O's. It's like the coach says, we can do it, and here's how. This is the way we're going to do it. And it's strategy, right? It's the how of the first 12 chapters. Because Jesus is better than any idea you've got, because Jesus is better than any plan you've got or any dream you've got, here's what it ought to look like. to look like a Christian. So if you're not a Christian here, you're kind of checking out church, I want you to know that these are the sorts of things that... See, you ought to have somebody who's the nice person who brings a clicker that works. So thank you very much. That was very nice, Carrie. Give her a hand. So, what was I saying? So this is what we need to figure out. What does it look like to be a Christian in this culture? The Hebrews didn't want to blend in. They didn't want to stand out. They wanted to blend in. And so let's see, what are the distinctive marks? What does it look like to be a believer? What makes me and you in the world, in this culture, stand out? And that's what Hebrews 13 is about. So look up Hebrews 13, 1. Pull it up on your device. Some of the verses are going to be on the screen here. Starts out like this. Keep on loving each other as brothers and sisters. That word loving there is phileo. It's a brotherly love. It's not really in the Bible distinguished from agape. They are almost used interchangeably. In phileo love, you would give yourself, you would give your life for the other. You would kind of spend yourself for the other. You would put yourself out there and sacrifice for your brother and sister. And basically, church is family, and that's what he's saying. Look to your right and your left. You're not looking at strangers. You're looking at brothers and sisters. So it ought to look different than the YMCA. It ought to look different than the country club. It ought to look different from any other organization you're a part of. You are looking at your brothers and sisters. This is family. Keep on loving your brothers and sisters. This love is where we got the name Philadelphia. The city Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. And they are some of the most hateful people. Don't go to a Philadelphia Eagles football game. There's probably some good people there. Look, loving people is hard work, isn't it? Are there Philadelphia people here? Oh, Doug, one of the most loving people I know. And your last name is Valentine. Okay. So I'm going to get past that. So look, loving me right now for Doug is hard work, but you need to forgive people. And you know, it's easy to love people who love you back. It's easy to love people who are nice to you. It's easy to love people who do nice things for you. That's not what this is talking about. This is actually saying to all of us, keep on loving each other, even when they're unlovable. And this is not just for our church. It's not just for Reality Church. We should love each other as brothers and sisters, and we should love the other churches in our community like they're brothers and sisters. You know, if you hear somebody talking bad about another church in our community, and you go to Reality, your response ought to be, oh, no. They are our brothers and sisters in Christ. Well, I'm not going to talk about the bride of Christ. That's what the Bible calls the church, the bride of Christ. You don't go around talking about somebody's bride. And we're not going to do that. So keep on loving each other. That ought to look different. You know, we're not rivals with anybody in the body of Christ. We're not rivals with them. They're family. And so we keep on loving each other. And it's hard work, especially when you don't receive it from somebody. You can't do any of this that I'm talking about today without Jesus Christ enabling you to do it. In other words, the love that you give somebody else, you got it from somewhere. And that's why Christians can love like nobody else, because we've got a source. We don't get emptied of love. We just connect up with Jesus, and he gives us. We're conduit. We're like the pipeline to love other people. That is the mark of a Christian. 1 John 4, 7, and 8 says, hey, let's love one another. For love is from God. You know, God is love. And if you don't love, you really don't even know God. Because that's who he is. That's his character. So love each other. Keep on loving each other. God's love coming through you. It's the most convincing evidence that we're actually of the faith, or that we're actually close to God. Genuine love like that makes the world scratch their heads. Everybody can feel for somebody. Everybody can have affection for somebody. But Christian love looks different, because Christian love is when somebody doesn't love you back, you give them the same love that you would give anybody. That causes people to scratch their heads. I've seen news stories where somebody's had a crime committed against them. Have you seen this? And a believer goes on the camera and says, you know what, we love them and we forgive them. And everybody's going, what? Live a life like that, that demands an explanation. Live a life that creates question marks in people's minds. Like, how in the world do you even live that way? And that's not emotional, by the way. Love is not defined emotionally. It's not a mushy feeling for somebody. Love is an action, and it's really defined relationally. We are brothers and sisters. I love you because you're a brother or you're a sister of mine if you are a believer. I also love you, even if you're not a believer, because you're an image bearer of God who made you. So I'm defining that relationally. Because I know who you are, I'm going to love you. That sort of thing. And where do we get that from? We get that from God. He's our source. That sort of love doesn't look like the norm. That sort of love stands out in a culture that doesn't know how to love that way. And it's been called the greatest proof of the gospel. Because it leads to something called, I like this clicker better because it has a better like feedback when I click it. Okay. Hey, can you guys control it from back there? Just not? Okay, good. So I don't love that. You don't have to love objects. You can actually actively hate objects, which I do. All right, so what love leads to is something called unity. Unity is the proof that the gospel's true. John 17, 23, Jesus is praying to God and he says, okay, God, I and them and you and me, may they be brought to complete unity to let the world know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. John 17, 23 is basically saying that when they are unified, it proves the gospel. Because unity like that is impossible without love that flows from God. So the next verse is, so that's love leads to unity. Hebrews 13, 2 says, don't forget to show hospitality to strangers. Now, if you were coming up with a list of things that would mark Christians, like this is the mark of believers, would hospitality make your list? It wouldn't have made mine. But that's what Hebrews says. One of the marks of a true believer, one of the marks of someone who's really in the family is that they show hospitality. And the verse gets a little bit weird after that. It says, because some have entertained angels without even realizing it. That's kind of spooky, right? You're picking up a hitchhiker and like disappear out of your car when you're... I don't know what that exactly means, but I think it's actually a throw... it's looking back to Abraham and Sarah and other people in the Old Testament who entertained angels and didn't know it. I'm not saying that God couldn't do this right now. He could. He's God. He can do anything. But I think it's just showing you that hospitality is the mark of a believer. In the first century, Christians couldn't afford to go to the hotels. They couldn't afford to go to the inns. Most of them were poor. Most of the early believers were poor. And so, and they couldn't afford to go to the inns, but they didn't want to go there anyway because most of them were brothels anyway. They were houses of prostitution, so they wouldn't go there. So they needed to open up their homes to each other, serve a meal, let them stay for a few days. As people, missionaries were traveling around, they needed to do that. But I know what this means for all of us. When I say, hey, open up your homes, I know what it means if you're anything like my family. It's a lot of work because, you know, people are coming over. And I'm not talking about work because they're going to mess things up. I'm talking about the pre-work. You know, we've got to make a good impression. We've got to pick up these socks. We've got to vacuum. We've got to make this house look like it never looks. So that when they come, we can fool them into thinking, this is the way we live. Come into our home. We always have candles lit and light ambient music playing. That's the way we live at my house. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of stress when people are coming over. You know, it's like, man, we got people coming. It cost us something. Maybe you're making a meal. But cheerful hospitality in this culture stands out. I mean, there used to be a day in America when somebody knocked on the door and everybody was excited, like, we've got company. There's actually a comedian who does a great bit about that. We got company. You know, it's so great. But now it's like, who is that? You know, it's the culture has shifted. It stands out when we give hospitality. It causes people to say, what's different about them? It creates a question mark in their mind. It demands an explanation. Hospitality like that, real hospitality like that, leads to something called community. Real community, where people feel apart. It's a great thing. I think that the best form of community is only available to believers. And I don't say that in any way of saying that we're superior. Actually, we're not. We've just tapped into the one who is Jesus Christ, who gives us community. We can't do it on our own. As a church, we're wanting this year to be an emphasis on becoming an inviting church. Not just a place that people would like to come, but a place where we actively go out in the community, we look for people who are going through transitions and other things, and we say, hey, would you like to come to Reality Church with me? Would you like to come to my house? And we're opening up our home. We're going to do a discussion group about the sermon series. We're going to ask people to do that this year. Maybe you're not in a life group, and that would be a way to get involved in opening up your home and becoming hospitable. It stands out in our culture when people open up their homes. Verse 3 goes on. So remember those in prison as if you were there yourself. Now, this is actually not talking about criminals, although the Bible tells us in other places to go and visit those in prison, including those who've committed crimes. This is actually talking about other believers who have been imprisoned because of their faith. Don't forget them. Feel for them. And it goes on to say, and also remember those being mistreated as if you felt their pain in your own bodies. Because they were being tortured, they were being beaten. There's a word for this. It's called empathy. Empathy doesn't mean feeling bad for somebody. Empathy doesn't mean, oh, shucks, that's too bad. Empathy is feeling their pain. Empathy is actually, and it happens sometimes, especially when you've been through the same thing. Some people ask, why did God put me through that? Why did I experience that loss? Why did I go through this, you know, this painful divorce? Why did I go through this loss of a child? Why did I go through this cancer scare? And sometimes, I don't know that I know the answer. In fact, I know I don't. But I think sometimes it at least enables us to stare across the table at somebody and say, and mean it, I get it. No, I really get it. You know, why did I fail out of college? Why did I lose that scholarship? Why did I fail to get that job? Why did I get fired? It's maybe so that you can sit in the same room with somebody, look across at them, and without lying, say, man, I get it. It's as bad as you think it is. I'm sorry you're going through this. There's some sort of spiritual connection that happens at that point that is so different than it sucks to be you. You know, that's not the same thing. Empathy. And empathy, when you hear about the mistreatment and the imprisonment, and do you guys know this, of believers around the world? How do you feel about that? When you hear about sexual slavery or people who are being abused, or people who are refugees, how does that hit you in the gut? The Bible says empathy, genuine empathy directed from your heart to somebody else's heart, leads to something pretty cool. It leads to healing. Now, I'm a fan of counseling. I think counseling is great to identify problem issues and things that you need to kind of handle, but I honestly think that empathy and community are what lead to healing. When you stare at people around a room and they know you and they love you anyway. They know all your stuff and they accept you anyway because they were accepted by Christ. So it leads to healing, really deep healing that nothing else can do that. That's why it's a mark of the church. Hebrews 13:4 goes on to say something that I think might hit us, and at least in our culture. Give honor to marriage. In other words, marriage is good. Give honor to it. Don't dishonor marriage. And remain faithful to one another in marriage. Marriage is a good thing. Remain faithful in marriage. And it goes on to say a judgment verse, God will surely judge those who are immoral and those who commit adultery. How are we doing in America when it comes to marriage? How's our culture doing when it comes to marriage? Would you say that our culture, by and large, would say marriage is a good thing? I wouldn't. I would honestly say that most people, when they hear that you're getting married, want to throw you like a funeral party or something. They want to say, oh man, I'm sorry to hear that. It's like, I've gotten rid of all of my other options. I'm getting a little bit older now. It's time for me to just throw up the white flag and get married. I honestly feel that way. What is wrong with people when they just want to delay and delay and delay until they're 30? You know, when people used to say, you know, I waited till I got married. Well, Grandma, you were 13 when you got married, all right? Congratulations. People are putting off marriage now, and it's really a struggle morally and for purity. So the thing is, marriage is good. Marriage is good. Guys, man up and marry her. Enough with this playing house. You know, let's move into the same place. You know, I'm not ready for commitment, but I'm ready to get all of the benefits of not being committed, of being committed while I'm not committed. Man up. I mean, this may be an ouch for you, but that's okay. We have a problem with masculinity in our society where people won't just own it and say, I'm going to be committed to you for life. That's a good thing. It's a beautiful thing. And we ought to do it and stay faithful. Sex is a gift from God. I've said this before, but God could have come up with any plan for us to reproduce. We could have ripped off an arm and thrown it over there and it becomes a baby. It's like, that would not have been as enjoyable. Sex, yay God, you know? He came up with it. So marriage is good, and be faithful. This fidelity to the institution of marriage is faithfulness, not just to the other person, but to the institution of marriage. It makes a healthy society, and it also creates harmony. It creates something called harmony. Harmony in your marriage, harmony in society. It's a good thing. We ought to do that. It ought to be the mark of a believer. And let me tell you this. What if just every believer did that? You'd change the country. This country would be so different. If every believer would do that, we'd be living in a different place right now. Kids would grow up healthier. Families would be harmonious. I mean, we could. There's a lot in that, and you guys know that marriages work, and that we have something called re-engage, and it's all about paying that price. But you ought to do it because it's a good thing, and it ought to be the mark of believers. Hebrews 13:5. If that one wasn't an ouch, this one might be. Don't love money. Be satisfied with what you have. Don't love money. Notice that doesn't say don't have money. Some people think the holier you are, or the poorer you are, the holier you are. That's not true. God gives people resources, but don't love money. Be satisfied with what you've got. That's a word, you know. Well, how can we be satisfied, first of all? I've got to have a reason to be satisfied with what I've got, because I've got at the core of me, I've got this desire for more stuff, okay? We are not very content as a society, are we? I mean, we buy phones when our old phone still works. That's insane. I mean, think about that for a second. Yes, but this phone downloads the app so much faster than the old one. So what? I mean, when I was growing up, if the phone worked, or you know, we didn't lease a new one from AT&T. That's how old I am. Don't love money. Be content. Be satisfied with what you have. How? Because God has said, I'll never fail you. I'll never abandon you. Your money is not meeting your needs. God is. It's His means sometimes to meet your needs, but He's the one who's not failing you. It's not your bank account. It's not a certain number. We've got to have a turn of our mind when it comes to our money. That's what the word there in that scripture says. You've got to repent when it comes to your love for silver, your love for money. You got to turn around. You got to love something else. See, money is not the problem with any of us. Usually, it's the way we feel about money. It's our security. It's our God. I was looking up a generosity map, a heat map of generosity across the nation. Totally shocked to find out last year that Nebraska, and specifically Sarpy County, is one of the least generous places in the United States of America. Not when it comes to volunteering. I mean, we volunteer like nobody's business. We're really good at it. We're 38th in states when it comes to financial generosity, and Sarpy County is on the lower end of the spectrum. Median income here is $70,121, and we give every bit of 2.5% of that away. I mean, you talk about people who are finding their security in their stuff, and a lot of that, let's be honest, a lot of that is because we didn't get out on the front end of contentment, and we've racked up so much debt that we've got zero margin to give anything away. Ouch. Right? You know, I was okay with all that fidelity stuff, and now you're talking money. This one hits a little closer to home. You know what? I believe that the writer of Hebrews wrote this because generosity ought to be a mark of the church. Contentment leads to generosity. That's what it leads to. You're not going to be generous if you're always wanting more and more and more. And believe me, I buy new stuff. I got a new shirt. A new shirt in Minneapolis. Got me a sweatshirt, a hoodie that I thought looked really cool with it. And I said, I'm going to preach in it. So I get new stuff. 70% off, though. Look, most of us are spoiled rotten. Most of us, we're not content with anything. You know what peace is, though? Peace doesn't come from that one more thing. Peace doesn't come from finally feeling like you got your head above waters. Peace comes from being content with what you've got. That's where it comes from. Be content with what you've got. Contentment is the only path to generosity. And these, because of this list, love, hospitality, empathy, fidelity, you know, all of these things together, this church was known for what they did, not for what they were against. They were known for what they did, not for what they didn't do. The Roman culture was not applauding them because they didn't take part in all the bad stuff that the Romans did. They didn't go, you know, those Christians, man, they're so awesome. They don't eat until they throw up. They're not gluttons. They didn't care about that. You know what they saw in the believers, the early believers? They treat each other differently. They treat their enemies differently. They're generous with their stuff. They saw it made them stick out. They were known for what they did in a hostile environment, not for what they railed against in the hostile environment. And there was plenty of stuff to yell about. This is how they did it in Hebrews 13:6. We can say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, so I will have no fear. What can mere people do to me? He's saying this to people who are going to have their lives taken from them by other people. So that's what they can do to you. They can take your life. No, that's okay. They really can't. Jesus gave me new life, and I'm going to look at them with confidence, and I'm going to say, this is who I am. I know that my life stands out. I know that it doesn't blend in. I know that it creates question marks in your mind. I know that you want an explanation for how I'm able to live this way. That's Christianity. We ought to live differently, believers, than other people around us. We ought to pay the price. We ought to go through that struggle. We ought to look different. We ought to look, smell, feel like Jesus instead of just like the norm. When you live this way, you're not going to be able to blend in. They're going to know you at work. And hopefully not because of your bumper sticker or because you always want to witness to people on their lunch break. No, because you're a great worker, you're an encourager, you're generous, you're hospitable, you're faithful. This is actually us turning away from the norm, which is a selfish life, into a selfless life. An attitude that looks like Jesus. I mean, when you look at culture, can't we do three things? We can condemn it. We can point at the culture like we're the little brother of the culture. I'm telling God, you guys are so going to get it when Jesus comes through those clouds. You know, when the flames of hell just start licking your feet, that's going to be. And some people seem like they're a little excited about that, like they're a little happy that people are going to go to hell. We can condemn culture. Point at it. Say, you're going to get it. We can counter culture. We can say, you know, everything you got, we're going to come at you with something better. You got that. We're going to scream in your face. We're going to make our signs. We're going to counter culture. We're coming at you. I think there's a better third option. As Christians, we create culture. Wherever you're at, there are thermometer people and there are thermostat people. Thermometer people, they walk into the room and they tell everybody the situation. This is what's going on in this room. Thermostat people walk in like Jesus, and they change the temperature. They change the culture. We create culture. We don't have to blend in. An attractive new way of doing life. We're bringing, as a church, a new reality that draws people to Jesus. But it also confuses them, and it amazes them. I want all of us, I want me, I want us to live lives that raise more questions than they answer. That's what Jesus did. Everybody who hung out with Jesus was going, what are you talking about, man? How do you live that way? Why do you talk that way? Why do you respond to people that way? They hit you in the face just then and you didn't hit back. They've falsely accused you and you didn't do the same thing back to them. Now, I just don't think people care whether you got a six-pack in your fridge. I think they care how you treat your coworkers. I think they care, what are you doing when it comes to the issues in the world? What, are you living outside of yourself? Live a life that demands an explanation. Live a life that creates question marks in other people's mind. This is hard work. In fact, I would say this. This is impossible. John 15 says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. If you abide in me, you know, you're going to do a lot of great, a lot of great fruit's going to happen from that. Apart from me, you can do nothing. You can't do any of this list. You can't love people like that. You can't be hospitable like that. You can't be kind like that. You can't be faithful like that. You can't do any of this without Jesus. And he was the best model. So to move from selfish to selfless just starts to look like Jesus. And it has real world consequences. Who can you love well this week? Think about it. Come up with a name. Who can you love well this week that can't repay you? Who can you surprise this week? Think of somebody. Who can you surprise this week with a calculated act of love? Not a random act of kindness. No, you've zeroed in. You're going to move into their life, and you're going to love them well. You're going to meet their need. What about hospitality? Who can you open up your house to? Can you open up your home to a discussion group this year as we're wanting to become an inviting church? Who can you invite over to dinner? Who can't repay you with a dinner? How can you radically develop hospitality in your own life? This has real-world consequences. Empathy. Who can you not just hurt for, but who can you hurt with? Who can you sit right there in the junk with them and go, man, I get it. I'm so sorry. How can you show yourself faithful to the institution of marriage and to your partner? How can you honor marriage? Maybe it's time for you to man up and say, you know what? I've actually been a user instead of a lover, and I'm ready to become a lover because marriage is good. I'm going to man up and become what God is calling me to be. What about contentment? What can you give away? What do you have entirely too much of? You know, we're asking you, obviously, because we want to reach more kids and more families to sign a launch card. Maybe it's your time to do that and say, you know what, I'm going to commit. I've been putting that off. I'm going to put that card into that rocket, literally into the new building. When we do this sort of stuff, I got to tell you, it's confusing. It's confusing sometimes to believers, but it's definitely confusing to a culture that doesn't get this stuff. But do it. Be a voice in a culture of echoes. Live a life that demands an explanation. Why? Because Jesus is better. He's better than the Old Testament. He's better than Abraham. He's better than Moses. He's better than the sacrificial system. He's better than any dream you've got, your plan. If you fix your attention on Jesus Christ, your life will be marked by these things. It will be marked, and you won't blend in. And if you can fix your attention on him, these things will start to characterize your life. Things like love, things like hospitality, empathy, fidelity, you know, contentment and generosity. Who did this better than anyone else? Well, Jesus himself. That's why on the first Sunday of every month, we come together and we acknowledge that he was not selfish, he was selfless. And we take communion together as a church. He modeled it. On that night, he brought his best friends, his closest followers, up to the upper room. And he said, I've been longing to take this supper with you. How in the world could he say that? Well, Hebrews tells us, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He had a joy in his heart, even though he's about to face the cross. That's different, right? That's confusing. Going to the cross, and he's got joy? That doesn't make sense in our culture. That demands an explanation. And his explanation was this, I've got the joy of bringing glory to God and rescuing you. You were worth it to him.